The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com. Metaxas Show with your host, Eric Metaxas.
Hey there, folks. It's the Eric Metaxas Show. Guess who my guest is today? Did you guess? It's Johnny Russo. Johnny Russo, I smile when I see you. I had you on here. It's got to be 2.5 years ago. Suddenly, COVID just...
I know. It's amazing.
...flew by. You've got an insane story. You got 1,000 insane stories. But for people who don't know anything about you, I guess the headline is you played Carlo in The Godfather. That's how a lot of people know you.
That was a big achievement 49 years ago.
Right? Is next year 50 years of this thing?
Yep.
Well, it came out 72 or 71?
72. Well, no, we made it in 71.
Yeah.
Came out in 72, and then we won like 5 Oscars, which I think, this is great. I was 25 years of age.
Right.
And I said, you know.
It's all downhill from here.
It was, too. I've done 46 other films, 9 more Oscars. The films won, not me, but it's fun being in them.
I would think so. But you didn't start out as an actor. Again, people who don't know you, it's almost impossible for you or anyone to tell your story because it's so unbelievable that it needs endless explanation, because it sounds like somebody would make something up. I mean, here's the headline. Let me say for people who are just tuning in, when you were 16, you slept with the 28-year-old Marilyn Monroe. Frank Sinatra was a friend. He taught you to sing. Where do you go from there? I mean, these are things that sounds like somebody would say it as a joke.
That's
but
funny.
You've lived an amazing, crazy life.
And here you know what's so funny? Where you're situated here, I was just telling my assistant, Megan, that I used to sit, before they built a shopping center, on steps across the street from Lee Strasberg's studio.
Yes.
And meet Marilyn here late at night. And who come out one night was Marlon Brando.
I was just going to
guess. Curtis.
Was it Marlon Brando?
And
was
Tony
it
Curtis.
Paul Newman? Was it Tony Curtis?
Because it was a higher advanced class of acting.
Oh.
Because they were all, she's already made like 6 motion pictures.
That was method acting.
Yeah, I know. I love it.
Method acting. You got to become the. But, I mean, this is what I'm saying. Like, you're not that old. You're sitting here. You're 78. You're doing a million different things. But you have had a life that.
Well, I started young. That's why.
Yeah.
I got a lot in early.
You got a head start. Yeah, yeah. Well, let's start. Your life, I mean, you were in a hospital for polio.
Yeah, this is my second pandemic. I got polio in August 1949. I stayed there 5 years, so this quarantine was a lot easier.
So it was a hellish thing. You were alone boy in a ward. Where was the hospital?
Bellevue, 30th.
Bellevue. Oh, right
East
here.
End, right here.
Not far. So you were there as a kid for 5 years?
Without leaving the ward.
Without ever leaving the ward because polio is contagious.
Yep. So at that time, it was really contagious. It was 2,700 kids died the first year. So that's a lot of kids. That, and without having the news and being all over the world, I don't know how many people. That was in New York City.
It's unbelievable. Yeah. So, okay, you get out of there. You're 12. What are you doing on the corner of, where was that? Fifth Avenue and, where the Apple Store is?
Well, I didn't get there right away. I stayed downtown for about 3 or 4 months. I was selling ballpoint pens. They just came out. And Leah Rabinowitz, who's a friend of my grandfather, had a stationery store on Delancey Street. And he had a sign about ballpoint pens, and he was so excited about these pens. is my grandfather used to walk down there to get pads and pencils for Carlo Gambino's club where they play Zigonette all night. So it's like the names just keep coming.
I was going to say, you can't stop. Even your grandfather was hanging out with these people. So you're telling me that you're a kid, you're not going to school.
First of all, I was still deformed.
How were you deformed? What do you mean?
The whole left side of my body was paralyzed.
So how come it's not paralyzed now?
That's why I go to church. I said novenas. I have no residual other than you would know it, but the left side of my body is smaller than the right side.
What did doctors say? What happened to you?
Well, see, first of all, I didn't have, you could have had polio so many different ways.
Yeah.
Could have been respiratory. That's why people were in iron lungs. You could have been deformed the rest of your life. Mine were all elasticity muscles. So I was able to rebuild them, but I still have, you know, I'm dwarfed. I wear two different size shoes. I wear two different size gloves. But unless I tell you that, you're not going to know that.
Yeah.
So I could walk down the street and nobody's going to, I don't have a limp. I have nothing.
I've seen you walk down the street and you look absolutely fine. So, but you had polio and back then, but you missed 5 years of schooling in this ward?
Yeah.
5 years.
I went to the first grade. That was it. It was the summer of 49. I was 6 and a half. I turned 7 December 12th. That's how I knew I was had the same birthday as Sinatra. And he was like a mentor because they mentioned that, you know, he was an Italian-American from Hoboken, humble beginnings, and now he's doing 6 shows a week, I mean a day, at the Paramount Theater. We're born the same day. So he encouraged me to get out of that ward, believe it or not. And then I met him 4 years later in person.
Well, look, you met everybody, but we got to get to that. So you're literally on the street selling ballpoint pens.
Right.
Now,
I was like left side all.
I've never thought of this, but because I grew up in a world years after you, but the idea that ballpoint pens were a big thing.
Yeah, no more ink. No more ink wells. You don't have to fill up your pen.
But who thinks about that? The idea of ballpoint pens came in, so it was a big deal. So in the 50s, you're standing on a corner selling ballpoint pens.
Well, first I exhausted everything downtown, Wall Street, banks.
What do you mean exhausted?
Well, I went to the bank. I don't know how I thought of this, because that's when people got paid in cash. You actually got an envelope.
I remember.
So they had to stagger the paydays. So Mr. Pinto, Marine Midland Bank, I asked him, and he looked at me. He knew I wasn't going to rob the bank. And he gave me the schedule. So I would show up after the paid envelopes just were given, and here I came. So they'd give me the change, or an executive give me a dollar for something I just paid 12 cents for. So after a while, I didn't even have to say anything. They'd open their drawer. They had more pens than I did. So I took the train uptown one day, and I stayed there, and I've been there ever since.
Yeah, you've been uptown ever since. So you go uptown one day. You're standing there selling pens, and what happens?
I'm standing in front of the Sherry Netherlands Hotel.
Still there.
It's still there, and I'm still walking by it every day. I know every dorm in there. And here comes a guy. Every morning he came for Sushine. He came from the west side with his friend, I thought. I found out later.
He came to the Sherry Netherlands for a Shoeshine?
Shoeshine on the way to the Waldorf. Every day he stopped by and bought his shoes, and that's who Frank Costello was. I mean, this guy. And never took a pen, gave me words of wisdom, but he always gave me a hug. And every time he hugged me where he would squeeze my left shoulder, which was my paralyzed shoulder. And this went on all the time. I couldn't wait for the guy to come. Because sometimes he'd give me $2, $5 a day.
But, then, you know, you just got to explain. Most people don't know who Frank Costello is.
Well, they had the nickname the Ambassador. He was the head of the Genovese family while Vito Genovese was in jail. So he was head of one of the 5 crime families in New York.
Right, but I'm saying, how do you describe him? You could say he was one of the arch criminals of the 20th century.
Oh, yeah.
You could say he was the king of the underworld. This is a powerful man.
Well, he amassed $30 million in the 30s being partners with Joe Kennedy in Prohibition. So, I mean, this is not only the underworld. This guy was a genius in business.
Oh, no. Clearly. And that's what's interesting is some of these people are geniuses.
Yeah.
But what I'm saying is most people who don't know him as a person, you would think of him as a very scary figure, a forbidding figure, a dangerous figure, a guy who's having people murdered.
He was dangerous, but, you know, the old school people, I mean, what we know now because of The Godfather and the John Gottis and all the Sammy the Bulls and these people who want to be flamboyant, most of the old timers, that's why it was called the secret society.
Right. La Cosa Nostra. We're going to be right back talking to Johnny Russo, and we'll let you finish this story.
Bows and flows of angel hair, ice cream castles in the air.
Hey there, folks. How many years have I been telling you about Relief Factor? What, like four? The truth is, I know there are millions of people, in fact, some say over 100 million people struggling with some kind of pain, maybe from exercise, just getting older. That could do it, getting older, which is why I am so impressed with Pete and Seth Talbot. They are on a mission. You rarely see this kind of focus and commitment. Seriously, they recently shared with me that they are doubling down and want to literally double their total number of happy customers in the next year, and I believe they'll do it. So here's the deal. If you're struggling with back, neck, shoulder, hip, or knee pain, even general muscle aches and pains, then I'm suggesting you order their three-week quick start, still discounted to only $19.95, about a dollar a day to see if we can get you out of pain too. And then after that, less than the cost of a cup of coffee a day to stay out of pain. Go to ReliefFactor.com, ReliefFactor.com, or call 800-500-8384, ReliefFactor.com, 800-500-8384. I use it. It works. Check it out.
Hey folks, Eric Metaxas here. Like you, I am sick of hearing about big tech companies spying on their customers, selling their data, and not being able to keep their platforms safe and secure. Luckily, I've found SquadPod, a private platform that helps businesses, organizations, churches, and nonprofits take back control of their communication. SquadPod has three things going for it that other companies do not. First, SquadPod puts you in control of who is a part of your team, what they see, and how they interact with the group. Second, SquadPod is 100% owned and operated in the United States. Third, SquadPod is simple to use. Just create an account, invite your team, and start communicating via their secure video and messaging features. Learn more at squadpod.com/Eric. That's squadpod.com/Eric. Let me say it again, squadpod.com/Eric. Check it out.
Make like a Mr. Milk Toast, you'll get shut up.
Folks, welcome back. Talking to Johnny Russo. The headline, you played Carlo in The Godfather, but forget about the headlines. You're telling us a kind of an amazing story. I was saying that Frank Costello, most people like me would think of him as very forbidding, very frightening because of the dark power to have people killed and the, you know, all that kind of stuff. But you're a kid on the corner and he treated you sweetly.
Oh my God, yeah. And then he gave me a job. One day, you know, we had a little confrontation because before I used to come uptown by train, I used to take the N train and come and get off at right there across the street on 59th and 5th Avenue, walk across the street. It was easy. And then I used to stop and see Carlo Gambino, because I used to call him Uncle Carlo, because that was the thing we did in the neighborhood. Everybody was your uncle. I thought I had the biggest family in the world.
Which neighborhood?
Mulberry Street.
Okay, so you did grow up down there.
Oh, no.
I didn't know that. So you grew up on Mulberry Street. So you knew Carlo Gambino, another figure, major figure in that world.
Oh, my God, yeah.
But so you knew some of these people as a kid, and when you get off the train, you said I would say hello to Carlo again, but where was he when you said hello?
No. I didn't get off the train when I was leaving to get the train.
Oh, before you got the train.
He was at Ferrara's. He didn't like the club, the coffee in the club, the Ravenite. So he'd get coffee there first.
Ferrara's, isn't it still there?
It's still there.
I've been there.
It's 115 years old.
Yeah.
And next door to it, as part of the story, is a religious store that's still there four generations. Where I still buy I give Holy Mass cards to a lot of people. And this one morning I'm leaving, and there's a Lagorn that most people know, the horn or the hands that you see, the maloikas, the Italians wear around.
I knew we were going to get to this, the maloikas.
So anyway, this one had a horn, the red horn, but with a hunchback on it. I never saw it in my life. So I said, Joe, what's this?
You're so wait, you're, how old are you now? 12? 13?
Yeah, 13. Just
okay,
school.
And you see the Gambino. Who do you see there? Or the person in the store, you're saying?
I saw Carlo even before I got polio.
Okay. I'm saying at this point, you said you see something in the store and...
I saw at the store the Lagorna that everybody wore.
The Italian horn, but with a humpback on it?
With a hunchback man on it. Yeah. Which I've never seen. They just came from Sicily. So I said, Joe, what's this? I never saw it before. So we just got them. They're from Sicily. I said, well, how come a hunchback? They said Sicilians like touching cripples.
Yeah, oh, yeah.
Well, that's what Frank was doing.
Oh, my gosh.
And that's what got me crazy.
You got upset.
Yeah, because I thought the guy liked
me. You thought he was nice. He was just trying to get a little...
luck.
Good luck.
So me...
That's an old, you know, they believe that stuff, yeah.
So me, I'm on to going to the train. They were selling the novelty things. There was a rabbit's foot. It says, for luck. I buy one. A pink one. I put it in my pocket. Here he comes. And he goes to touch my move. He says, what are you doing? It's nothing. He goes to touch my move again. He says, what are you doing? I says, not what I'm doing, it's what you're doing. I thought you liked me. You're touching me like I'm some kind of freak. And he turns to his bodyguard, Blackie, who I thought was his friend. He says, you believe this kid? He says, what's your name? I said, Johnny Russo. He says, oh yeah, who's Angelo Russo? Angelo, I says, my great uncle. He says, when'd you see him last? I said, what's this, a quiz show? I said, I never saw him. You should know that if you know him. He said, why didn't you see him? I said, because they hung him in Sicily in 1948. So now he knows I know. Unbeknownst to me, my uncle sent all of them to America. And that was the end of it. I had a job until he died. I was with him until 73.
So he gave you a job at that
point. As a runner. Just to, and schooled me. I was basically did his errands for the first 2 or 3 years. Then I started traveling the world. Well, I traveled America first. 17, I started going to Vegas every week.
But when you grew up on Mulberry Street,
right.
Did you know that this was what we today call the mafia? What did you think of it? Did you think these are bad people? What did you think?
I was 6 years old. I didn't think anybody was bad. They weren't talking about it. First of all, they never talked to kids about it. They were all, like I said, my uncles. I thought I had the greatest family in the world. And you know, I knew nothing for those first 6 years other than being down the neighborhood.
Right. So, and then you're in the ward for 5 years.
Yeah.
And then you get out.
And then I get on the street.
So when Frank Costello, who, if people look him up, I mean, he's just an unbelievable name in the lore of mafia lore in the 20th century, he kind of pulls you under his wing as you're the kid.
That's it. Exactly the name, too. The kid. Most people didn't know my name until The Godfather came out.
Because you were the kid.
Always the kid.
So... if you're hanging out with somebody as powerful as Frank Costello, I would imagine a lot of people would also fear you in a way, that you had a certain privilege. It's like being the son of, you know.
I like to say respect. They didn't fear me. I'm a little skinny kid.
But I'm saying
they knew.
But that's kind of it's just an interesting thing because doors are opened. Everybody, you know, wants to kiss his ring. So in a way, they want to kiss your ring in a way. And you're right. So young.
Well, that's the funniest thing you should say because getting out of the polio ward, I told you, I was mentored subconsciously by Sinatra because he look what he achieved. And now I used to go to Copa every day. It was like 4 o'clock in the afternoon when I used to go and drop off envelopes to Carmine because whoever was bookmaking or whatever, I brought the envelopes to them. And there's a line outside already. So I go down through the kitchen and Sinatra's voice I hear. He's rehearsing. So now...
this is the 50s.
Yeah. So now he sees me and he looks at Modell, and it was the first time I heard this, says to him, no, that's Frank's kid. Don't worry. He's all right. And he keeps rehearsing. So I figure, let me sit down. This is Frank Sinatra. I'm looking at Frank Sinatra singing. So as soon as that was over, he puts a cigarette in his mouth. I run over and I light it. And he says, "What's your name, kid?" I said, "The kid." He's the kid. He said, "Who gave you that name?" I said, "Mr. C." He said, "Well, I guess I won't ask that question anymore." Just like you said, because of that, I had a relationship with him. In fact, he baptized my son Luciano, my last son Luciano. And, you know, it's crazy.
He was the godfather for your son.
Yeah.
So Frank Sinatra, and you say he taught you to sing.
Yeah.
I mean, there's so much I want to talk to you about, and so our time is a little bit limited today, so I'm thinking, what do we have to talk about today? How about this? Your clothes. Every time, the reason I first saw you, I was eating at a pizzeria on Lexington with a friend, and I keep looking over at you, and I had no idea who you were, but the way you were dressed, something like you're dressed now, I kept thinking, that guy is somebody. I can't put my finger on who it is. And I kept looking at your face, trying to figure it out. Because usually I've got a sixth sense of, you know, celebrities and stuff. I can spot them in an alley from the back of the head. But I couldn't figure it out. And then you and I got talking. And, you know, you told me that you were in these different movies and things. But it's kind of funny. You've got a real personal sense of style. Where does that come from?
Again, it came from Costello, then later on Johnny Agnelli, who was the Mr. Fashion.
I was going to say, Agnelli, yeah. That's a big name in fashion. Huh. But still, when you think of these mafia guys, they're wearing like fedoras and long coats. They're not dressing like you dress.
No. And that's one thing I wanted to, even younger, I wore a lot of, I didn't want to be in the blacks and the grays and the hats and the things, because I wanted to have my own identity and not be identified, because I was moving, you know, millions and millions of dollars. The last thing I wanted people to see me at airports say, "Oh, that's a mafia guy." And next I want to check my luggage. And that was before 9/11, believe
me. Right.
So, no, I was always had a flair for color.
Yeah.
And in 1957, I flew to Switzerland to meet Johnny Agnelli.
And why in 57? What was that?
Well, you have another hour for that. This watch was in a window called Van Cleef & Arpels in 1957. It's a Cellini Rolex, one of a kind.
This watch?
This watch. So Mary used to give me coffee, cocoa.
Who's Mary?
She was a sales girl in there when it was cold, me selling my ballpoint pens. So when they put the watch in the window, I said, "Can I have the serial number of that watch?" And she said, "Why?" I said, "Someday I'm going to own that watch. I made it a goal. I'm going to save enough money to buy it."
I can't even begin, if it's in Van Cleef & Arpels, what a watch in the window cost.
Yeah, well, I found out it was $9,000.
Then?
Then.
Okay, so that's like $150,000 today.
Yeah, it's probably. Like,
sure.
Well, most people don't know. See, it's all diamonds embedded in it. But anyway.
Yeah.
So he gave it.
Well, okay.
Long story short.
No. This is, all right, we're going to go to a break. Ladies and gentlemen, why do I need to tell you to stick around? Because you'd be crazy not to. We'll be right back.
Just to get a glimpse beyond this illusion, I was soaring ever higher.
Prescription Dispensing Labs is a national licensed pharmacy specializing in personalized prescription and natural medicine. The pharmacists at PD Labs are credited with formulating unique nasal sprays for the dreaded brain fog and a leader in uncovering new compounds to improve your health. PD Labs is one of the first pharmacies to now offer a telemedicine group trained in prevention medicine and how to restore your health. They have developed signature professional supplements that really work rather than just promotional advertising. PD Labs Pharmacy prides itself on innovation and amazing customer service that show dedication to your health. Today, everyone needs a choice in their healthcare, and they bring many refreshing options on how to maximize your body's amazing capabilities to bounce back. PD Labs has an extensive network of practitioners nationwide dedicated to true healthcare, not sick care. Visit their website, pdlabsrx.com, for free health tips, podcasts, and their popular online store. Call 888-909-0110. Ask for Ray and tell them Eric sent you. That's 888-909-0110.
Folks, I'm talking to Johnny Russo, and we are talking about everything. It's such a delight to talk to you, Johnny. You were talking about fashion. I heard you say in another podcast that you've come out with a clothing line.
Right.
And it's not out yet, right? Or maybe
it's,
when
it's
this
21st.
Airs.
Well, by the time this airs.
By the time this airs, it'll probably be out.
Yeah, by the end of May, go to La Cosa Mia.
Which is funny. Not La Cosa Nostra, La Cosa Mia.
That's what I'm on to, you know, I'm on to keep the thread going.
Yeah.
By Gianni.
Yeah, by Gianni.
And shirts, all these accessories, shoes.
Now, these shirts, I saw you wear a shirt with like a double collar. Like, I've seen that kind of stuff. What is that?
I designed them. I've been designing my own shirts for 10 years. That's why when they approached me to do clothing, I said, wait a minute, I got my own line. They couldn't believe it. And so these collarless shirts,
yeah.
I've been designing these for 10, 12 years. You could see pictures of me on stage with these shirts on.
Yeah.
And everybody commented me on them, but I was going to, you know, now I'll be selling them in Nordstrom's and Dillard's 380 stores. So.
Unbelievable. Do you still have property in Las Vegas?
I have a lot of property. In fact, I just talked to my son yesterday, Gianni, and we have a ranch I forgot I had that he's living on with his kids. And now he's raising miniatures, and he's making a ton of money. Miniature horses. And I mean, my kids are pretty smart. But I have a lot of property. I have 23 acres of land right behind between Hard Rock and MGM Grand, still there.
Okay, so obviously that has increased astonishingly in value, but you don't want to sell it?
No.
Why? Why?
Well, you know, for what? I mean, my grandfather told me if you need money, you sell something. I don't want to sell it. Somebody wants to develop it, I'll subordinate the land, which could be a nice ownership in a hotel.
Interesting. The last time you were on this program, you told the story of how you essentially, and again, people think we're making this up, brokered the deal for The Godfather to be made.
Well, I got it made after, well, first of all, Joe Colombo was picketing the FBI building because his son was arrested, and he created this whole anti-defamation league. And then the book came out. And
you mean the Godfather came out, Mario Puzo book came out.
And I wanted to be an actor, my ego. And I thought that would be a great shot because they said they were going to use unknowns. So then I figured if I fix this for him, and I always knew the mob, that if you could show them how to make money, he'd take his pickets down. And he did. And I brokered the deal, and here we are now, 49 years later, talking about The Godfather.
And who is left from that cast? I'm thinking the only one I could think of is Talia Shire, James Caan, Pacino is still around. Every time I see Pacino in The Godfather, and I see him in anything after, it's like a completely different person.
Oh,
I cannot figure out.
He's such a great actor.
Well, he's a great actor, but what I'm saying is the role that he played, he's young, and to me, that's Al Pacino. And then when I see him in subsequent movies, I think, is that still Al Pacino? It's like, it seems to me like he kind of went in a different direction or something like that.
Well, and that was a young role, and that was the only young role he could play. And look how he matured in that. You know, in that movie, he matured 50-something years.
Last time you were here, you told a story that because of what James Caan did to you, which we don't need to go into, that you hate his guts to this day.
I hate too much energy. I don't hate anybody. I just got rid of it.
Good.
As a thought. He's done.
So you wouldn't kill him if you had the opportunity?
Oh, no. I don't kill people.
Alvin, we have the tape, Alvin. Johnny said it right here. You said if you got a terminal disease, he better look out.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you didn't get to that end.
Huh?
If I get a terminal disease, I want everybody to tell me anybody they want. If they're bad, I'll take them out.
You'll take them out.
Why not?
I'll tell you why not another time, Johnny, another time. There's so much to talk about. We talked about the death. I heard you talk about the death of Marilyn Monroe, and you said some stuff I just found astonishing. You knew her as a human being.
Yeah.
You really knew her. How many years did you know her? I mean, if she was 20, you must have known her, 11 years? 12
no, years. 4 years only.
I thought she was 28 when you met her.
She was. You said that. She was in her 30s, 31 or 32. She just did Some Like It Hot.
How old was she when she died, 36?
I don't know.
Okay, so you only knew her 4 years.
Yeah, I knew her 4 years, that's it.
Okay, so somebody got the math wrong, I'm sorry. But the point is you knew her as a human being, and you talked about, it's just fascinating because you're there on the inside and you're with all these people. And you said that a lot of the men around her, whether it's Sinatra, whoever, your words were they all had their way with her.
Well, she gave herself to them. You know, she thought that's all she had. I mean, her body, and everybody took advantage of it. You know, we had parallel lives. When I was 12, like you pointed out, I was in a polio ward. When she was 12, she was in an orphanage. Looking at the water tower in the Valley of California of Warner Brothers, and she made it her mind up to be on that lot, and she got there. Which is interesting, though. Your audience, a good friend of mine, has a book that you and I spoke about before you went on, Mark Shaw, Collateral Damage. I can't believe what this guy's written for us and for your audience. The book is coming out like next week.
Collateral Damage.
Collateral Damage.
And what do you mean what he's written for? No, we're out of time in this segment. Okay, folks, I'm talking to Johnny Russo. It's the Eric Metaxas Show. We'll be right back.
Snow. Seaman.
Hey there, folks. It's the Eric Metaxas Show. I'm talking to Johnny Russo. Yeah, unions. They have their rules. Let me ask you, Johnny, you were just talking about a book, Collateral Damage, but you said he obviously is a good journalist because he writes about a lot of this stuff.
I know. I can't believe it. He's been on my podcast, and we spoke so many times, and he's a facts guy. You know, he really does his homework.
But does he write stuff that other people don't? Because when you talk about the death of Marilyn Monroe, you seem to have this inside information, and there's so many controversies and so many... Nobody seems to know what really happened. You get all these different versions.
Well, I think he's cleared a lot of it up because, you know, he sent me the book, and I briefly went through it because I'm not a great reader. But the buzzwords and the doctors' names and all that, he's done his research.
Okay, when you say the doctors' names... You say, like, flat out, Marilyn Monroe was killed by the Kennedys. Like, you're not saying metaphorically. You mean they had her murdered.
Robert, not they.
Robert Kennedy
right.
had her murdered.
Yeah.
If you don't mind, sure. tell me about that.
Well, the only reason I could say that, because I knew what was going on, they were all invited. Robert, John, and Joe Kennedy were invited to Cal Neva the last weekend in July. And if she was killed, August 5th.
Where's Cal Neva? What's that?
Cal Neva is a resort on the border of California, Nevada. They owned it together.
The Kennedys?
No. Joe Kennedy had a piece of it. Sam Giancana, Sinatra, and Dee Martin. So they're all sitting poolside. The photographs I have around my house, and he has some in his book that I just noticed yesterday, were taken by Sam Giancana. Imagine having him as the photographer. But the thing was they were going to blackmail, they thought, Robert and John one more time at Marilyn Monroe, and that would be the end of them because they... The mistake John made was make his brother attorney general. John never spent time with his little brother, I guess, to know that he hated his father and even John and what they stood for.
Now I'm missing something. John Kennedy, the president,
right,
didn't know that his brother, Robert Kennedy, hated his father?
Yep.
And how does that relate to the story? I'm missing it.
Because when he made him attorney general...
Right.
He went after all his father's friends. We're going to lock them all up.
Okay, so RFK went after the mafia hard, and John Kennedy never dreamt his brother would do that.
Exactly. In fact, he was called in when they made the announcement. They called John and Joe.
When who made the announcement? Well, that they're going after the...
No. When he made the announcement, he was going to make his brother the attorney general. They called Joe and said, you got to stop that. This is not what we put your son in office for. Because the mob made Joe. I'm John, President of the United States. Joe.
So his father, let's just go back here. His father, Joe Kennedy.
Right.
Was it sounds like, very wrapped up with the mob.
Well, Prohibition, him and Frank Costello made $30 million each. Who were they selling the booze to? The mob.
It's a fascinating thing because it really is right out of The Godfather. I want my son to go legitimate. I want him to become a senator or something like that. That sounds like the story of Joe Kennedy.
Mario Puzo collected all this stuff. Why was Joe Kennedy such a property owner in Chicago? He owned department stores. He owned everything. No, I mean, the Midwest and them, I mean, that's when they created the syndicate. So when he went with to them and said, if you make my son president of the United States, we will invade Cuba and give you your casinos back. So it was a win-win thing. So Meyer Lansky, everybody jumped on board for this. So now they made him president.
So, I mean, it all sounds like a conspiracy theory, except you're telling me this is simply what happened.
It's simply what happened.
And when you say they made him president by stealing votes in Chicago.
Not stealing votes. No, no. They got every union in the world to vote for them. All the Teamsters, the Culinary, International Longshoremen. That's how Marcellus got involved. Anastasia got involved. They controlled all the unions. And I still had to take a flight to Dallas, Texas, and drive out 30 miles out and deliver $3 million to a farm, to a ranch.
I don't get it. When, for what?
And 3 weeks later, Lyndon Baines Johnson became his running mate. He hated the Kennedys, but they made a deal. John was going to be in for 8 years, and then you'll go to the next eight. They controlled the White House for many years. Nobody knew that.
Well, do you believe LBJ was in on the murder of John F. Kennedy?
There was no other person in the world that would have taken him to that. He's the only guy. He had the route. And the Texas Rangers were the backup, God forbid, the three shooters that you think Lee Harvey Oswald was Marcello's shooter. New York had a shooter. Chicago had a shooter. They were going to kill John. They were going to start to kill the kids. That's what they told Joe. That's when Joe had the stroke. But I thought it was Robert was the target. I knew there was something going on. Someone's going to get killed.
Why did they want to kill John F. Kennedy? We've slipped sideways, but go ahead. Go ahead.
Why?
Yeah.
And when I tell you, you're going to say, wait a minute. Because John F. Kennedy told them in person he was definitely going to do what he was going to do.
Do what?
Invade Cuba. Give them all the casinos back. It was about money.
But then he failed at the Bay of Pigs.
Not only that, because he hired his brother. His brother told him there was no missiles there. And his brother took him away from Sinatra. I was with them 3 or 4 years prior, every night almost.
With the Kennedys?
No, with John being groomed. Peter Lawford was watching him. Sinatra said he can control him. This was a conspiracy that was well laced and ready to go. Sinatra produced the inaugural. I was sitting 10th row from the podium. I was at the inaugural. I was 20 years old. Everybody said, who's this guy?
Did you get to meet Robert Frost?
Who?
Exactly.
Oh.
He was the poet who read some poems at that inaugural. You skipped that part.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, I'm sure. I'm not into poetry.
Yeah. All right. Dante. You like Dante. Hey, we're going to be right back talking to Johnny Russo.
And they said you were going to put me on a shelf. But let me tell you, I got some news for you. And you soon.
Hey there, kids. I hope you're ready for another segment of Ask Metaxas. Alvin, I'm going to play the role of Metaxas, if you don't mind.
Yeah. That sounds great. You do that, kid.
Let me take
you
a crack
that.
At it. I think I can nail this one. I don't mean the question. I mean playing the role of Metaxas. Okay. We get all kinds of lovely emails from people, and thank you for these lovely emails. Very encouraging, sweet. Thank you. Some critical. Thank you for those, too.
Yeah.
But then we get questions. Someone named Sarah says, I just finished reading your book, If You Can Keep It. That's my book, If You Can Keep It.
I really enjoyed the book. However, the portion of the book that talks about how virtuous Washington was has me a little confused. I realize he did a tremendous amount for the founding of our wonderful country, but he was a slave owner. Can you give me some insight into this? Mm-hmm. As it turns out, I can. Ooh. I think slave owning is wrong. I actually think slavery is wrong and the slave trade is wrong. And I wrote a book about a guy named William Wilberforce. The book is called Amazing Grace, who led the battle against the abolition of the slave trade. I don't think okay. there's anyone.
I'm going to put you down for a no on slavery.
Yeah, I'm against slavery. But this... this is an important point. And in my book, If You Can Keep It, I also talk about George Whitefield, who I can never remember if he owned slaves or was pro-slavery. This is like, you know, in the 1740s and 50s. But we need to be gracious in dealing with figures from the past for many reasons. We can never say that slavery is okay. Far from it. It's one of the most wicked things in the history of humanity, but slavery has existed since the beginning of time. It wasn't invented by some white guys like 400 years ago, right? As the 1619 Project would have you think. Human beings, broken human beings, have had various forms of slavery since the beginning of time, and it was only bringing the gospel of Jesus into the culture that led Wilberforce to abolish slavery and the slave trade, and that led most people in the West to do the same thing. And it's horrifying that it took so long. But we also have to remember that in the 18th century, there was not a single landowner like George Washington who didn't have slaves. So the idea that he would somehow be beyond that or above it or whatever, I think that's unreasonable. I think the question is how he treated them. Did he provide for their release upon his death? I mean, these are at least mitigating factors, but there's just no question that we all know it's a horrifying thing, and it's horrifying that Whitefield participated in it. It's horrible that Washington participated in it. Again, the issue is in the details to me, not whether they accepted it, because I can't think of literally anyone at the time who was against it, except for a handful of Quakers and then Wilberforce and some evangelicals. It is important for us, not because of one thing, to condemn someone for everything. That's cancel culture, and that is not right. It doesn't mean we don't have to make a judgment. We talked about that on this program. Sometimes you make a judgment. Somebody was a bad person, okay? Stalin was a bad person. Just because he did some good things, just because Hitler loved his dog Blondie, like, that's not going to make me say, well, we need to give him a pass because no. But in the cases of Washington and Whitefield, I think overwhelmingly, if we're honest, we have to say that even though we know that certain parts of their lives were grievously wrong, what they did must be praised, lauded, celebrated. They did some outrageously wonderful things. And if you read those chapters in If You Can Keep It, or in my book, Seven More Men or Seven Men on some of these figures, you just realize they did things that if they hadn't done these things, we would not ourselves have freedom and self-government today. And I actually believe the government that ended up fighting a war to end slavery would never have done that, would never have come into existence and had the ability to say, we need to end this. We need to fight a civil war where 600,000 white boys die because it's that important. Fortunately for you folks, we're out of time. Thank you.